Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Until just recently, I did not know that truffle oil, the vast bulk of truffle oil, that is, contains no truffles. Somewhere in a lab, there are these people who cook up a chemical knockoff, so it's artificial stuff. Somehow, I just did not get the truffle oil memo. Another thing that I have learned is that the grand appeal of truffles, for those who are really in the know, the memo-receiving people, unlike me, it's probably the aroma. It's not so much about eating them. It's about smelling them. And apparently our next guest first smelled truffle without taking a bite. And if I got the story right, he didn't even have to pay for it, that first whiff. Logic would say that if something's that rare and that beautiful, you ought to pay a price for it. I am pleased to introduce to you Rowan Jacobson. He's author of Truffle Hound, On the Trail of the World's Most Seductive Scent, with Dreamers, Schemers, and Some Extraordinary Dogs. Rowan Jacobson, welcome to our show.
Thanks, Marcus. Great to be here.
I want to begin with that first whiff. It may not have been your very, very, very first encounter with a truffle, or was it?
It was my first encounter with a serious truffle. Like you, I think I had had some truffle experiences in the U.S. with, you know, truffle fries and truffle oil and things that I thought were truffle. But in terms of like a high quality fresh truffle, this was my first one.
And where was it exactly? And what did it look like? And how big was it? And where was it positioned? All of that.
It was pretty big. It was probably the size of a tennis ball, which is a big one. And that's why it was being displayed under, you know, a glass bell in the center of this very fancy dining room in a restaurant in Barolo in northern Italy. And this was the fall, the peak of white truffle season. And I was there to meet with a bunch of people for this wine tour that I'd been asked to speak on. And I just walked by and noticed the truffle there, and I knew it was truffle season. And I just started to lift up that bell to smell it, and the smell that came out completely floored me. And I was kind of curious about truffles, but I hadn't expected that that smell alone was going to send me, you know, down this rabbit hole of basically a 3-year journey to write this book.
Was it kind of like a drug?
It is absolutely like a drug, and other people have made that comparison. It affects your mind in a way that makes no sense unless it's doing something, you know, below the level of consciousness like drugs do.
Are you making this up, or is there really some kind of chemistry going on, some neurological understanding of what how the entrapment works?
Well, that's a really good question, and I don't think anyone knows for sure. People have definitely taken a stab at it. They've looked at the aromatic molecules that are produced by truffle, and it's incredibly complex. There's at least 200 different compounds that have been discovered so far made by truffles, and some of them are ones that certainly go with the drug theory pretty well. One is anandamide, which is like a cannabis, a THC-like substance that the brain actually makes independently, and it produces, you know, sensations of bliss. So truffles have a little bit of that going on. We know that they make pheromones that make pigs very horny. Whether that actually works on humans or not, you know, the jury is still out. But there's lots of anecdotal evidence, at least.
So I'm not really joshing here when I say that maybe the effect of the truffle scent is so powerful, it could lead people to do things that are, you know, against the law. There are criminals in this whole story of truffledom.
Yeah, you know, and certainly the story of truffles for a couple of centuries has been that they tend to be a black market item found in the wild and sold through supply chains that, you know, the tax man is never seeing any part of. So they've always had a reputation as kind of an underground food. And is part of that because they have this almost drug-like effect on the mind? Could be.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about them a little bit more sort of scientifically in terms of where they're located, how they grow, who grows them, can you grow them even, and why are they so rare?
They're rare because they are a wild product, and they live underground all the time. They're actually the fruiting body of a fungus that lives underground. And the fungus is microscopic. It's made of these little microscopic filaments. But when it wants to reproduce, it makes a truffle, which is like a ball of spores. It's kind of like a mushroom that never opens up. And so it's underground. So how do you find it? And it's not like it's in any one obvious spot. We know that truffles have a partnership with trees, so you're going to find them where you find trees, but that means you spend a lot of time walking through the forest to find a few truffles. But we have a partner who makes it much easier on us, and that is our four-footed companion, the truffle dog.
You say truffle dog, and I had always heard about pigs, so this is a bait and switch for me.
Yeah, and everyone else. The pig myth is pernicious. It once was pigs. Like everyone thinks that probably the way that people first got clued into truffles was farmers watching their pigs, you know, start rooting around in the forest any chance they got and scarfing up these funny little stinky potatoes, as the farmers used to call them back in the day. Pigs go crazy for the things. So then people started taking their pigs into the forest on purpose once we got a taste for truffles. And kind of what you would do is like you'd bring like a little like bucket of grain with you. And once the pigs start digging for the truffles, so you know where they are, you throw some grain, the pigs go and start eating the grain, and you dig up the truffle before the pig can get it. But that system was always kind of awkward. The pigs really like the truffles. So, you know, there's these stories out there of nine-fingered truffle hunters who were trying to wrestle a precious truffle out of the mouth of their pig. Also, pigs are really big. So if you have to load a pig into your car to go truffle hunting, A, everyone knows exactly what you're doing, and B, it's just a bad fit. So starting in the late 1700s, everybody switched to dogs. Dogs are great. They're really good at smelling the truffles. They're easier to train, and they don't care that much about eating the truffles.
Oh, I'm going to say, they're not apt to bite your finger off.
And they rarely bite your finger off. The good ones, certainly.
Well, I want to go back to sort of the biology of this, because you say it's the fruiting body of the larger fungus. And I'm imagining this as kind of almost a microscopic kind of web under the ground. I don't know.
Exactly. Yeah. And so these are these mycorrhizal fungi. And it's just like, it's for us, it's a very different concept of what a body is, because they don't have a center. They're just this web of tiny, tiny filaments, really microscopic. But they go all through the soil, and one teaspoon can actually have miles of these filaments in them. So that is the organism. But then when it wants to get reproduced, when it wants to spread its spores around, how's it going to do that as an underground organism? How's it going to get those spores far away? So what the organism has figured out is that it makes that little ball of spores smell incredibly good to an animal, so that the passing animal will feel compelled to dig it up, eat it, and then later spread the spores through the forest.
Oh, so it's actually dependent for dispersal. It's utterly dependent upon an animal digging it up.
Completely. And so it's basically a truffle is like a 2 million year test case in how to convince an animal that you're irresistible.
How large can the fungus be underground? Not the fruiting body, but the fungus that produces the spore body.
Good question. And it's hard to measure because, like I said, it's just these like miles of infinitesimal filaments. But we know that some fungi can just get immensely large. There's a kind that you find in Oregon called a honey fungus that covers thousands of acres, and if you took all those filaments and were able to weigh them without all the dirt that they're a part of, it would be as heavy as like two blue whales or something. So fungi can get really big. The ones that make truffles tend to be smaller. They're partnered with one tree or maybe a handful of trees underground. So their overall body is going to be pretty small too. The truffles might be a significant part of them.
Now, this isn't just all book learning for you, because you're the type of person who goes to Italy and then smells the truffle there, and you're hands-on about this whole business. So you went truffle hunting, or have done?
Oh yeah. So I spent then a great deal of time basically begging truffle hunters to take me out with them because, of course, just like mushroom hunters, they all hate to give away their spots. But eventually, they once they saw that I was really excited about it and that I wasn't going to, suddenly be in business against them selling truffles. I just wanted to eat them and write about it. Then they were pretty happy to take me along. And it was funny. What I found is that the truffle hunters don't want attention for themselves. They don't want anyone to know what they're up to, but they all think their dogs are awesome and they kind of like the idea of their dogs getting some publicity, you know?
That's really funny because they'll blow their cover if they talk about too much of what they do, right? They are secretive about this and they're concealing their knowledge.
They are secretive about it because anyone else could come along and steal their spot. So they really don't want you to know what their great spots are, at least if you're a potential truffle hunter. So they go to great lengths to conceal those places. In Italy, they always hunt at night, which makes it a lot harder. And they have all these excuses for why they hunt at night. One, that they don't want anyone to know what they're doing. Two, that the air is cooler and there's no wind, so the truffle scents sort of are stiller on top of the ground and the dogs can find them better. They have a lot of excuses, but then the other factor is they usually have day jobs, so you
Yeah.
have to hunt at night. That's your only option.
Well, okay. Tell me a little bit about this because this is really interesting. The idea that there's this truffle hunt tourism where you can go and sign up to go on a truffle hunt and it's not really authentic.
Yeah, we've sort of had this farm to table revolution with so many ingredients in both in the US and around the world where everybody wants to know where all these ingredients come from. And truffles kind of were like this the last old school luxury food that were not a part of that. They were just like they would just be in fancy restaurants. But now suddenly it's really changing and everyone is captivated by the idea of these truffle hunts and seeing where the truffles come from. So in France and Italy, places like that, they're trying to adapt and bring people out to see the dogs in action and to see where the truffles are harvested. But like we were just talking about, they're not about to reveal their spots. And also most tourists really aren't up for, 4 hours of mud and misery in the middle of the night, unlike me. So what's happening is they are taking all these people out on truffle hunts all through Europe, and everyone thinks they're real. But you go out with your truffle hunter and his dog, and you hit a truffle within like 10 minutes, and within an hour, you've found two or three white truffles, and then you get back on your tour bus or whatever and go back, and everyone's really excited. How lucky that you found two or three white truffles. But if it was that easy, these truffle hunters would be making millions of dollars every year on their truffles. What's actually happening is they're burying some truffles that they've previously found in an area that they, have some control over, and then going out with the dogs and the tourists. So A, they're not revealing a real spot, and B, the dogs really are, their dogs are doing what they really do all the time, but it's guaranteed that they're going to find these truffles.
Yeah, that's a kick in the gut to think about that, isn't it?
Yeah, at first, for me, once I realized that, it took something away from the experience. But you're still like the most fascinating thing is just watching how the heck these dogs can find these things. And so that's still real. Like the dogs don't know it's faked.
Yeah. Well, I suppose there's something there to it. One of the things that really interests me is the idea that do all great things have to come from Europe, or is there a chance that the New World might offer some of this for us too? We're going to talk about that. Our guest is Rowan Jacobson. He's a journalist and author of Truffle Hound: On the Trail of the World's Most Seductive Scent with Dreamers, Schemers, and Some Extraordinary Dogs. Okay, level with me. Are you just a dog lover and that's why you wrote the book, or is it more about the truffles, really?
I do like dogs, but for me, it definitely was the truffles and the hunt. The idea that that one of the world's greatest ingredients is like hiding out there in the mud, and you can only find it with a dog. Like, this is probably a billion-dollar industry worldwide, and it's entirely dependent on dogs. The whole thing falls apart without them. So I love that they're a key part of this and that they're really revered for it. So yeah, the dogs were a huge plus. But for me, it was that first just like elemental draw that I need to like experience this thing more and understand it.
Do you know which kind of dog, which species is going to be most likely to be a successful truffle hound?
Ongoing debate in truffle world is, yeah. There's a famous Italian breed called a Lagotto Romagnolo that is specifically bred for truffle hunting and has a ton of cachet. And, you know, a lot of the top hunters use Lagottos. Now people in the U.S. are super excited to get their hands on a Lagotto and pay sort of, you know, minimum $5,000 to get one. But then you some of the best hunters in Europe I talked to said, you know, any dog off the street can do this if you get them when they're young and you train them properly. So people have strong preferences, but I've seen everything from a dachshund to a black lab do very well at truffle hunting.
Yeah, you put up, you put a dachshund up against a pig, and one of them is going to look a little bit more noble, I think. I don't know which, though.
I've been impressed by some of the dachshunds. Obviously, they can only do it in terrain that is appropriate, you might say.
Yeah.
But they've got the chops, you know. They can do it.
Well, you said the word worldwide just a moment ago, and now I'm thinking about how the market has been flooded by some inferior quality truffles.
Yes, and this started to be a problem maybe 20 years ago, where there's the very famous black truffle, which is originally came from France, is most closely associated with France, has a bunch of lookalikes out there that come from other places that don't have nearly as good a smell, but even the experts can have trouble telling them apart. And one of the main ones grows naturally in China, in the rural part of China. And once people realized that this truffle was a dead ringer for the truffle in France that sold for, you know, $800, $1,000 a pound, there was this kind of like gold rush to dig these truffles in China, and unscrupulous dealers in Europe started buying them and passing them off as the great French black truffle. And some of the schemes were pretty shocking. Like there were loads of truffle where half the truffles in them were not the French truffle. It was the Chinese truffle. The dealers sometimes were not picking up on this, and the chefs sometimes were not really picking up on this, which doesn't say much for their noses, because if you're smelling the truffles you're buying, it's easy to tell which ones have the great smell and which ones have none.
Okay, then how is your nose?
Oh, there's no question. A ripe truffle has an intense smell that just sort of almost makes you like fall over. And then there are other truffles that either aren't ripe or are of an inferior species, and they don't smell like anything. So anyone can tell pretty quickly. But what's happening in restaurants, and this is really not true anymore. This was more so 20 years ago before everybody caught on. But often chefs, especially in sort of like second tier restaurants who were really trying to, you know, cut down on costs, they would buy the cheap truffles whether or not they knew it. And they're shaving them at the table, these super thin little slices over your dish, pasta or whatever. There's a lot of presentation. And the look of the truffle and the performance were actually what people were paying for more than the smell of the truffle in the dish. And often what was happening is chefs were using truffle oil, synthetic truffle oil, to sort of provide some truffly smell to the dish, and then shaving the cheap truffle over the dish for the customer.
Yeah, it's just a buyer beware scenario. And you're either in the know and a real connoisseur of the stuff, or you're not in the know, and you still feel good at the end of the day because it was so fun to have the act performed for you.
I think you hit it on the head there, is that these chefs were still giving people what they're looking for in a sense, but we're all a little more savvy about ingredients now. And I think that combined with some changes in the marketplace, partially driven by technology like cell phones, which allow truffle hunters to connect directly with chefs and with even with individual customers that's all changing. And the ability to get your hands on a top quality truffle, it is just like so much better than it ever was before. So I think we're going to see a transformation in truffle culture because of that.
You know, in the olive oil world, there are the people who will say, you know, it's got to come from Italy or it's got to come from Greece. And people will poo-poo other regions of the world producing olive oil. I mean, you know, it's like, well, what was that? The Pace Picante commercial, you know, New York City. You're supposed to say, how's anybody going to make good salsa from New York City? So let's talk about some of the global supplies here, because I understand Croatia and Hungary. And then also I want to talk about our side of the world.
Yeah, exactly. And it turns out you could make pretty good salsa in New York City. You know, you do it right. So that's kind of what people have discovered in the truffle world too, is that, you know, there's this kind of this hierarchy thing where the French did a fantastic job of promoting their black truffle as the great black truffle, and you really couldn't get it anywhere else, and you had to come to France. And the Italians did the exact same thing with their white truffle. But they almost like painted themselves into a corner by doing so, because it turned out that they actually only had a very small amount of the supply. So once they had popularized these things, they didn't have enough to support the festivals that they had created, where people were all coming to Italy because they had to have the white truffle of Alba. So they were importing all these truffles from Eastern Europe, which turned out to have a bigger supply than Northern Italy did, and passing them off as Italian truffles, just because they were caught in this self-created trap where they had to claim that Italy only had the good white truffles, and then they had to keep pretending that these great truffles that they were selling, which really were great, were from Italy, which they weren't. So now that that world is kind of being cracked open, and there's more information out there about where truffles are coming from. So people are realizing that Istria, Croatia, Hungary, all these places that I went hunting have great white truffles that are just as good as the ones in Italy. And people are realizing that the great French black truffle is almost entirely farmed in Spain now. And the Spanish for decades just sold them to French dealers. And then they were, you know, marketed as French truffles. But now everyone's realizing that they come from Spain. And they're the same great truffle they always were. So the world is getting democratized in that way.
Well, I like the fact that there are, you know, organizations like the Hungarian Federation of Truffling, but at some point it becomes a little quaint when you start having truffle knights and a patron saint of truffling, Saint Ladislaus. You know, that's I guess that's just kind of the cultural trappings around the whole enterprise.
Yeah, you know, there's that like old Europe quaintness that I think we as Americans are especially susceptible to. We kind of love it. I kind of love it too, but it's quaint and precious, and there's all this hierarchy built into it. And at some point, you realize that it's definitely sort of stifling real knowledge and innovation. And sort of those like core American qualities are being brought to the truffle world now. And so in America, you're seeing a very different type of truffle culture arising. And it's kind of, to me, it reminds me a lot of what has happened in the wine world over the past 30 or 40 years, where for a while people were sort of in service to the idea that Bordeaux and Burgundy were the only great wines and that America would never have great wine. And then America started producing some amazing wine, and the rest of the world did too. And people realized that you could have these great ingredients come from anywhere as long as you do it right. You do the hunting right. You make sure you get ripe ones, and you have an open mind to the particular species that might be local to your area.
So speaking of local areas, Appalachia, Oregon, we actually have good truffles in the United States.
We have great truffles. And that was one of the big revelations for me working on the book, is that I definitely bought into sort of the old school myths at first, that you had to go to Europe to get the great ones. And those are great truffles over there. And I knew that the U.S. had truffles, but they did not have good reputations. But now I understand that the reason for those bad reputations was not the truffles themselves necessarily, but the way those truffles were being treated. And I've just been shocked at how good some of these American truffles are, and equally shocked that nobody knows about it. So that's my other takeaway, is that I think American truffle culture is about to get really, really good. And that's going to be super exciting.
So the way you treat a truffle, can you elaborate on that? Are you talking about the way it's harvested and then stored and then distributed?
Yeah, all of the above. So Oregon's a good example here. They have a black truffle and a white truffle and a couple of other truffles that have incredible aromatic qualities to them, but only when they're ripe. A truffle, just like a any other fruit, when it's unripe, it really doesn't have very interesting smell at all, purposefully, because it doesn't want to get eaten yet until it's ready. So then once the truffle has grown and the spores have matured inside, then it's going to turn on all those great aromatics. And that's when a dog is going to detect it, because the dog has been trained to look for those aromatics. But in Oregon, the truffles grow just a couple of inches under the ground in pretty soft soil. So what people realized they could do there is, if they kind of figured out the right area to go to, they could just take rakes and literally just rake all of the soil under the trees for sometimes an acre to get every single truffle that was growing in that first layer of the soil. But what happens when you do that are a couple of bad things. One, you really screw up all the microorganisms that are in that soil, including the ones that are making the truffles. So it's not good for the trees. It's not good for future truffles. But two, you're getting every single truffle, 90% of which are not ripe yet and don't have much smell. So Oregon got a reputation. It had truffles, but it got a reputation that for having truffles with no smell. But it was because it was like they were picking peaches that were green and rock hard and trying to sell them. And so what was missing was the dog element. Dogs only detect ripe truffles. So a couple of people in Oregon have really pushed dog culture. And now everyone understands that you're supposed to look for dog harvested truffles in particular. And those, when you get those from Oregon, they're really good.
Is that going to be a marketing kind of slogan that, you got a picture of the dog on the packaging?
Yeah, literally it is actually there's going to be a little logo. That's where things are headed for sure. The other issue with the Oregon truffles is they have a very short shelf life. So they go from incredible aromatics to, like spawn of Satan in about 4 days. So they have to be handled very carefully, and you got to get them super fresh.
Yeah. Tell me what you really think about an old truffle.
Oh man. Yeah. It's like, it can flip so quickly from so good to so bad. So it's an issue.
Well, Rowan Jacobson, a pleasure to learn from you. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Rowan Jacobson is author of Truffle Hound, On the Trail of the World's Most Seductive Scent with Dreamers, Schemers, and Some Extraordinary Dogs. Truffles, the creme de la creme of the fancy fungal feast crowd. But truffles are just a subset of living organisms that produce spores. The author of a jaunty and yet highly instructive book titled Fungipedia joins with us to help us keep things clear across the spectrum, from great tasting mushrooms to the kind that you wouldn't want to eat to the kind that you should never eat. I'm Marcus Smith. You're listening to Constant Wonder. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. We're talking about fungi, and so far we've been focusing on the mysterious, expensive, delightful truffle. We're going to broaden out that conversation now and explore some fungi that you definitely should not eat, which is many, if not most of them. Here's a conversation I had with Lawrence Millman. He's author of Fungipedia, a brief compendium of mushroom lore. And we got into things with an important question. Are you, Lawrence Millman, a kicker of puffballs?
No, except I sometimes, when I'm leading walks, I talk about the gentleman who was perhaps the first mushroom scientist and or mycologist, a gentleman named Clusius, got his start in the 16th century when, as a kid, he was kicking puffballs and watching the clouds of spores rise up out of them. But no, personally, I'm not, unless I'm leading a mushroom walk with kids, and I want to tell them that. Because I'm hoping that the world will have more mycologists in the future and fewer corporate CEOs.
Don't we all wish that? Now, here's the thing about the puffball experience of mine. I live in a very arid climate, and we do have some forests here, but I'm out in the Intermountain West of the United States and a place called Utah, and I was hiking. I was just stunned to find a puffball growing in a place that seemed so dry. And most of my experience here in the West has been that I thought that fungus are kind of scarce just because I associate them with damp climates. But apparently I'm very wrong.
Well, you're very wrong. I hope you'll forgive me for saying that. But there are what's called xerophiles, that's X, not Z, who indeed tend to specialize in growing in damp climates. And there's even an entry, if you are so bold as to look, in my Fungipedia on those. And then I spend a lot of time in the Arctic, which has been described as a desert. It's not really a desert, but it is often rather dry, and it certainly gets less snow and less moisture than the temperate areas, and there is an incredible range of fungi there.
Now, I am at that entry right now on xerotolerant fungi, and you write that certain less conspicuous xerotolerant species are not particularly pleasant. Why would they not be so pleasant?
Well, it just depends. If you are delighted, for instance, to see bread mold and get off on that, then you might find them quite pleasant. And there's all sorts of aspergillus molds on stored food that depend upon a kind of dry cutoff chamber, such as one might find in a refrigerator or a pantry. And if your bedroom had an open ceiling and it rained down on them, they wouldn't be there. That would be nice for other mushrooms, but not for them. They, you know, what's remarkable about mushrooms or fungi, and I ought to I'm going to use the words interchangeably, but formally speaking, a mushroom is a mushroom-shaped mushroom, and it's also a fungus. But these bread molds I'm talking to you about, and the puffball that you kicked once upon a time, are not mushrooms. They're fungi. But for purposes of this conversation, I'll be using them interchangeably. And, you know, my feeling is that what's so remarkable is how specific they are in their needs. I mean, there are various fungi that grow on the cockroaches of certain, or the antennae of certain cockroaches. There's one that's helping to recycle the Titanic. Well, you would never find it, for instance, in your garden mulch. It's on the Titanic. It's a marine fungus. And indeed, when we go back, you mentioned the origin. We fungi and us animals share a common ancestor 500 million years ago, a one-celled planktonic-like organism, whereas plants have a totally different ancestor. We're not related to them at all.
Now, it sounds to me like you have a certain delight in the fact that they're very, very old, and especially that they're still everywhere. If they're down with the Titanic, but also maybe in the dry leaves of my compost pile that I forgot to water and it all turns into aspergillus and it's a whitey powdery thing, mm-hmm. and I'm not supposed to breathe it because it could give me farmer's lung, but it might be in my bread in the pantry and then in a forest. If it's everywhere, mm-hmm. that kind of makes you happy, doesn't it?
Well, it makes me happy. And I mean, they're usually doing something good, too. They're recycling. They tend to work as what's called saprophytes, recycling dead organic matter. And even the parasites, the ones that are recycling living and more or less healthy organic matter, trees and human beings, of course, are doing a service because there's an old saying, from death comes life. And if it weren't for death, our planet would be vastly more overpopulated than it is now.
Let's stay on this theme for a little while, because the recycling of materials, everything seems to be in motion on this planet until we put it in formaldehyde, and things are breaking down all the time, and then life forms reemerge out of the compost of it all.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to tie in to all the cyclical concerns we have about our Earth these days. People are wondering about where things come from, where they go to, where the inputs are, where we put stuff. Are fungus really going to be so important to the way we manage, you know, this biosphere of ours?
Well, I think right now, for instance, they are helping us fight climate change. And I should mention, this is mycorrhizal fungi. These are fungi that have an underground relationship with 90 to 95% of all plants and trees. And they need carbs because they're like us, so do we. We can't photosynthesize. They can't photosynthesize. So they're connected with something that can. And the tree is pulling CO2, or the plant, CO2 out of the atmosphere and giving 20% of its carb to a fungal partner. Now, it's a mycelium, something you'll never see because it's only one cell wide, but it's the workhorse of virtually every fungus except for a few yeasts. It's what creates that fungus. So in doing this, and replanting is such a good idea because replanting means eventually there will be more symbiotic friends in the form of fungi with the roots of that plant or tree, which means more CO2 that we have so happily poured into the atmosphere is being pulled down by the plant and to give much of it to its fungal partner.
So when I was a kid, not long after the 60s, there were still people, protesters with signs saying, don't pollute. I'm wondering if the slogans of the future will just be more mushrooms.
Well, it could be, but I think that's a little optimistic. There still remains a spirit of what's called mycophobia, and it may be inherent in our species, just as arachnophobia, fear of spiders, is inherent. And, you know, don't touch that mushroom. Stay away from that mushroom. It may be poisonous, but in fact, there are far, far fewer percentage of poisonous mushrooms, you mentioned this in your intro, than there are poisonous plants.
But some of them are just so icky. I found some slime mold growing in my yard, and it oozed, and it glubbed. It was icky.
What's wrong with that?
Well, I don't...
What's wrong with oozing?
Well, that's pestiferous and pustulant.
Pustulant. Well, oozing. I mean, you know, somebody who cuts open a human being and looks at its inner organs, our inner organs, not its, could see a bit of ooze, too. Anyway, slime mold isn't a fungus.
Oh, it's
you
not.
Know, it is much more related to algae, protozoa, and so on. There are oozy fungi, mind you.
Well, let's look at the broad...
I don't want to deprecate them by saying they don't ooze. The stinkhorn. Have you ever seen in Utah a stinkhorn?
You know, it doesn't sound like something I ever want to see.
Oh, please. Well, you're not alone, because I quote Thoreau. It's one of my favorite Thoreau quotes. He found, this is a fungus that has what's called a gleba on the top. It's sort of, well, talk about oozy. It's a greenish, slimy mess that attracts flies because it smells like ripe carrion. And it attracts flies, not because it wants to engage in sort of personal contact with them, dipterans being so cute, but it attracts them to come and spread their spores. Now, what Henry David Thoreau, who is one of my heroes, said upon looking at one of these, pray, what was nature thinking of when she made this? She almost puts herself on a level with those who draw in privies.
You know what?
I am a great fan of stinkhorns. I am, in fact, I met a friend some years ago, and we both agreed that we liked stinkhorns and that we wanted to rehabilitate them, and we formed what we called the ASS, American Stinkhorn Society. but at its peak, it had exactly 8 members.
Well, you know, what you are pointing out here, though, is serious in a way, because our mycophobia, did you call it? The fear of mushrooms?
Mycophobia, yes.
Yeah. There are all sorts of sensibilities that people have that are kind of silly, particularly if we're going to get silly about the stuff that is so fundamental and so ubiquitous, mm-hmm. and helping the earth to kind of keep spinning.
You know, it's odd that spiders, fungi, snakes, they're all incredibly ecologically, and they all inspire phobias. But what could I say that doesn't? Well, domestic dogs, there are far more people, I mean, 5-6 times more people who die annually from dog bites than from mushrooms, and yet we don't have a phobia about dogs.
Now one of the things about Fungipedia, your book, that is so delightful, is that it invites amateurs and neophytes to come participate in learning about mm-hmm. mushrooms. There's science in it, but it's not the kind of thing that you can't read. And there's a lot of fun in it.
Yeah, that was utterly intentional. I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, on a certain level, I'm a missionary, but I'm not trying to make conversions into a religious faith. I'm trying, in the instance of this book, to convert people to an interest in mushrooms. And these are people who, now the common phrase is citizen scientists. Have you encountered that phrase before?
Yes, indeed.
Well, that's whom I'm reaching out for. I'm not reaching out to university professors, although in a couple of instances, professors have told me they have discovered things they never knew by reading the book.
Here's something I never knew. I've never come across the oxymoron noble rot before. That's a beautiful...
Noble rot, yes.
That's a beautiful thing.
No, it's a beautiful thing. And actually, I personally would use that for what's going on in many dead and dying trees. Rot. But it's noble, because if it weren't going on, and it's going on, and it will refurbish the ground, it will add incredible nutrients to the soil. In the process of rotting, it'll provide homes for birds, insects, and so on. One thing I should mention, what's very dry rot. Now, I've been studying that a bit. Dry rot is something that causes people to wince and back off. But it's something that people have in their homes. You're familiar with it, right?
Sure. You get these cycles of wet and dry, and if you have exposed timbers.
It's called dry rot because the mycelium, which I mentioned before, can go over long areas, pass over long areas of dryness like concrete and mortar, etc. But this is a fungus that exclusively grows on dead wood in the wild. And it has, I won't use the word graduated, but jumped to homes because those homes are, from the fungal point of view, considered deadwood, really deadwood. I mean, a log out in the wild may still have a little life left in it, but wood in a home, there's virtually no life whatsoever. So it's easy picking for the fungus. And a lot of the wood that is being recycled, especially if the tree is still semi-healthy, they're defenses against the fungus. And the fungus has defenses against those defenses, and, you know, they fight. But in a home, that wood has no defenses. So you'd think if you were dry rot, or indeed a fungus that rots wood, wow, what a splendid restaurant for me.
Lawrence Millman is with us. The book we're talking about is his. It's titled Fungipedia, A Brief Compendium of Mushroom Lore. One of the things that I've been scratching my head about, Lawrence, as I got ready to tell our listeners that you were on the way, I was teasing them and saying, stick around because Lawrence Millman's coming. I mentioned something that maybe is true and maybe isn't. It has to do with edible mushrooms needing to be cooked if the human body is going to digest them properly. Do you know anything about that?
Yes. This is absolutely true. There are certain mushrooms, like the common supermarket butt mushroom, that has an ability to provide you with a mild form of cancer. if you eat enough of it over an extended period of time. So it's best to cook all mushrooms. Morels, I'm sure you have an occasional morel out in your neck of the woods or your neck of the sound, but morels can be toxic if eaten raw. There was a famous incident where in Canada, where the chef didn't know this, and it was a convention of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and he served them raw on a salad, and there was a queue of sick Mounties at the emergency room of the local hospital. So, to be cooked, there's only one. Admittedly, I'm not an expert on edibles because I find edibility the least interesting aspect of any fungus. But there is only one that I know of that can be eaten with impunity raw. And I don't know if it's in out there or not. It's called the beefsteak fungus. And check my book. I believe I might have an entry on it.
But the idea here is that these mushrooms that we chop and put raw in salads, they might have a harmful effect if consumed in certain quantities. And beyond that, I read that your body just can't even digest them well until they're cooked. There's no nutritive value from them.
That's true, but basically, cooking gets rid of some of the toxins that are very mild toxins. But in the case of, there's one, there's a famous instance of a mushroom that's a perfect edible. I've forgotten the common name. It was eaten in France, man on a horseback or something like that. And several people died from it. It turned out that they had overeaten it. They had eaten vast quantities in a 1 or 2 day time. Now, I'm wondering what would happen to you if you ate, I'm trying to think of something right now that would be problematic, that would be an edible in small quantities or even average quantities.
Well, I'll give you one right here. I just happen to know that if you use too much cinnamon or too much kitchen sage in huge quantities, you might have a problem.
Yes, exactly. But I'm thinking, what if you ate 9 pounds of broccoli in a day and a half? And I mean, it's true of water too. You can actually kill yourself by drinking too much water.
Yeah, they call it water poisoning, I've heard.
Water poisoning, yeah. Right.
Well, before I say goodbye to you, because our clock is ticking here, tell us about Big Laughing Jim.
Big Laughing Jim is a mushroom that has a toxin that makes people who eat it laugh. And some people eat it in order to laugh, but they also suffer reasonably serious but not fatal gastroenterological problems. And, we have it, I think, all across the country. And there's a famous instance where a woman was in a car being taken to the hospital. She had eaten some, and she was sick, but she was laughing. And she said, "Well, if this is the way you die from eating mushrooms, I'm all for it."
You know, Lawrence, you say right up front that your guide is not a guide. It's a compendium. It's not a cookbook. It's not a field guide. And you are an ethnomycologist. That's a curious species.
Well, I am. And that's how I got interested in fungi in the first place. I was doing ethnographic work in the north, and every once in a while, I'd come across with a native person. They would tell me, "Oh, we use this as an insect smudge, or we use this to, in certain instances, to combat a cut or a wound." Like you'd mentioned puffballs earlier, it could well be the same species. The northern Canadian Inuit, if they have a cut or a bloody wound, they will take the puffball, squeeze it open, and put the spores in the wound, which will serve not only as a styptic, stopping the flow of blood, but as an antibiotic. We all know that fungi have strong antibiotic qualities. If this was a really serious, dangerously infected wound, it wouldn't work. but a cut, such as one might get from a scissors or trying to spear a seal. Yes, a puffball. And they used to have, but they don't anymore, special little leather bags made from caribou hide that they had attached to their belts that when they see a puffball, they would put it in that little bag.
Lawrence Millman is author of Fungipedia, A Brief Compendium of Mushroom Lore. Now, don't let that word compendium scare you away. People don't say compendium all that often anymore. This is simply an A to Z treasury with illustrations, more than 180 entries. Here's a few examples. Alice in Wonderland, Santa Claus, poisonings, how insects farm fungus is in there, and of course, why fungus are among the most significant of all organisms on the planet. BYU Radio invites you to join with us and other listeners in performing 10,000 acts of service. This is a 30-day project. It's a very lofty goal. All you have to do is perform some kind of service, large or small, and there are great ideas available for you from the website justserve.org. It's a great resource. You can discover volunteer opportunities by zip code. justserve.org. Let's say you're in Egypt on a Nile cruise and you not only get food poisoning, but you end up providing a home to a whole mess of the worst bacteria on the planet. Seriously, I'm talking about the kind of bugs that are not afraid of the toughest antibiotics that anybody could throw at them.
So it turned out that the pancreatitis was just a symptom for this much larger problem. But that wasn't all. Inside that abscess was the worst bacteria on the planet. It had just moved in and found this nice little apartment. And it was later sequenced and found to be an Egyptian strain. The nickname for it is Arachibacter because so many veterans have come back from the Middle East with this organism. But its real name is Acinetobacter baumannii, and it's considered to be one of the most highly drug-resistant bacteria out there.
Be very frightened, or at least frightened enough to want to learn about bacteriophages. Phages could become a routine component of the medical arsenal. They're so small you actually need an electron microscope to see them, but your body is full of phages, spelled with a PH, by the way, and if you get the right phages at the right time, they could be life-saving. We'll talk about it tomorrow here on Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Our show is a production of BYU Radio.